I would like to introduce today's speaker, Christine Kowalski. She is an implementation scientist and qualitative methodologist at the Center for Clinical Management and Research at VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System. Christine is trained in epidemiology and has extensive experience in health services research, applied implementation science, and rapid qualitative methodology, coalition building, and communication. She has led and expanded several national implementation and qualitative methods collaboratives and managed the process of implementing the Cooperative Studies Program implementation plan requirements for VA ORD. And Dr. Andrea Navidal, who is an investigator and senior qualitative methodologist, implementation scientist, Center for Clinical Management Research at VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System. Andrea received her PhD in anthropology from Wayne State University. Over the last 10 years, Dr. Navidal has trained hundreds of researchers on how to use diverse qualitative methods and how to use the consolidated framework for implementation research, CFIR, using rapid qualitative methods. Her research focuses on provider and patient perspectives of healthcare delivery and implementation and sustainment of evidence-based innovations. Christine and Andrea, take it away.
Thanks, Whitney. Thanks, everyone, for joining today. I know it's a super busy time, so we really appreciate you being here. We're excited to share some guidance on conducting rapid qualitative analysis. But before we begin, we'd like to give a big thanks to VA Query for funding our Rapid Qualitative Methods for Implementation Practice Hub that has enabled us to do this work and to offer training to other researchers. We'd also like to give a big thank you and acknowledgement to our amazing co-authors and hub collaborators who are listed here. Our first objective today is to share a brief background about why we developed the Planning for and Assessing Rigor in Rapid Qualitative Analysis framework, also referred to today as the PARCA. Our second objective, which Christine will do, is to provide an overview of the PARCA framework and its key elements to consider when planning for and conducting rapid qualitative analysis. So first, I just want to give just a basic background here. So as you can see in the figure, there's been a significant increase in demand for rapid qualitative methods. Part of this is because rapid qualitative methods are appealing to researchers because it offers a more systematic yet more focused approach to qualitative analysis. Despite the growing interest and demand, there's been very little guidance on best practices on conducting rapid qualitative analysis, and existing guidance and qualitative checklists typically focus on traditional qualitative methods and often are used later on during the publishing phase, so after the research is done. In addition, I personally have found, and I know my colleagues have too, that when working with and training others, people often have misperceptions that rapid qualitative analysis is easy, that everyone should use it, or it's an approach that should be used by more inexperienced qualitative researchers. So we're hoping to dispel this a bit today. So I just wanted to give just a really basic background on rapid analysis approaches and some trade-offs. Traditional qualitative analysis approaches often include in-depth manual coding of transcripts using software programs. In contrast, rapid qualitative analysis is deliberately streamlined and designed to be less resource intensive to meet a shorter time frame. The results provide more of a high-level, bigger picture view. And for those who may be less familiar with rapid qualitative method, we wanted to provide just a very basic schematic here in this figure of some different approaches. We don't have time to go into all of the bits of this, but just wanted to kind of give a basic idea. So with each approach to rapid analysis, there are important trade-offs to consider, which we focus a bit more on the paper that's cited here. One of the common rapid analysis approaches that has been primarily, you know, associated with what Allison Hamilton does, Dr. Allison Hamilton, is indicated by the orange arrows and uses summaries of interview notes that are enhanced for transcripts that are then transferred into an Excel matrix. Another more immediate rapid analysis approach relies on, which is indicated here with the yellow arrow, relies on summaries from interview notes that are then transferred into an Excel matrix. The matrix summary is often also verified using audio recordings. So now that I've shared just kind of a basic overview of what rapid methods are, I want to explain why rapid qualitative methods are important to implementation science, which is critically important to VA researchers. Rapid qualitative methods have increased substantially, as noted in the figure, over the past decade in quality improvement, health services research, and these methods have also gained particular traction in implementation research and practice. Rapid analysis is beneficial for a wide range of reasons, especially because it allows us to provide real-time, rapid adjustments to optimize implementation processes and outcomes. Rapid methods allow us to tailor implementation strategies in a more timely and efficient manner. Rapid methods help us to identify and understand key constituents, perspectives, and more quickly disseminate important information to our partners or to other people that need it. It also helps us to obtain multi-level assessments of intervention acceptability and potential need for adaptation. So given the rapid increase in demand for rapid qualitative methods and the need for more guidance on best practices, we developed the PARCA framework. The framework helps us to address the following questions. What does rigor entail in rapid qualitative methods? What are common misperceptions about rapid qualitative methods? How can teams plan for and conduct rigorous and valid qualitative projects? How can authors articulate the rigor in their method section? And how can reviewers understand and evaluate the rigor of rapid qualitative methods? The methods for developing the PARCA framework included a qualitative evidence synthesis to identify key gaps in the literature, a review of our training material for the Rapid Query Hub, and our expert panel, which used a consensus-based process of iteratively identifying, describing, and discussing the framework items over the course of 1 year. The PARCA framework has 5 overarching sections, which covers rigorous design, data collection, summary template development, matrix analysis, and data synthesis. Within these 5 sections, there are 18 guiding elements tailored to rapid qualitative methods that specifically support rigor and validity by offering recommendations for rapid qualitative study design, conduct, dissemination, and review. So here I just have just a really small snapshot from our paper showing the rigorous design section and the 7 elements that are included, just to kind of give you a little sneak peek of what is in our paper. And now I'll pass the presentation over to Christine so she can provide a great overview of the 18 items in the PARCA framework.
Great. Thank you so much, Andrea. And thank you all so much for joining today. You know, because I was a presenter, I didn't get to do kind of the little introduction that I normally do at the beginning. So I just wanted to say it's wonderful to see all of you here. And I recognize a lot of the names. So thank you so much for joining. It's very much appreciated. As Andrea said, this was kind of a labor of love for everyone that's in the Rapid Qualitative Hub and represents like 18 months to 2 years worth of work. And I also just wanted to say, because I didn't get to it at the beginning, please put your questions in the Q&A panel anytime. We would love to hear from you. And we're hoping to leave a good 15 minutes at the end to have a lively discussion and hear from you. Andrea and I would really love to hear from all of you what you think about this and what questions you may have as we go forward. So if you could go to the next slide, Andrea, thank you. So I wanted to just start out with this very briefly, and this is kind of will segue nicely with what Andrea was just talking about. So I assume that because all of you are here, you've at least heard about rapid qualitative methods and maybe have some sense of what they are. But what we find a lot of times is that people are unsure of when to use them, and very importantly, when not to use them. So before I actually step through the individual PARCA elements with all of you, I wanted to just briefly go through this figure. So if you're looking for it, you can find this figure in our new implementation science manuscript. And I'm just going to quickly read through this so you have an idea. It's true when you're using rapid qualitative methods that you have a shorter timeline. You can potentially have a reduced budget. You can have a quicker turnaround to your intended audience, which is really why we say these methods marry so well with implementation science. A lot of times, like Andrea was explaining, in implementation science, there's a need to get information back to the people you're working with very quickly. And some of the traditional qualitative methods don't really enable you to do that. For example, if you're waiting, you know, 2 to 3 months for a transcript to turn around. Also, you may be working on something like a longitudinal study that has multiple data collection and analysis waves. That would be a good fit for these methods. And when you have a data collection that is targeted, we like to call it targeted, telescoped, focused, and you're relying on something, I don't know if you've heard of this term, but we find it super helpful. The reference here will be at the end. This high information power, which just basically means you're going to collect data from participants that have highly salient knowledge or experience related to your research questions. Those would be, you know, benefits, good fit. Some common myths, and Andrea was talking about this a little bit too, are that these methods are easy, that they can be conducted by inexperienced researchers, that they're less costly, and that any team member can do them without prior experience. That's definitely not the case. And so I'll reiterate this kind of as we go through each of the elements. So if you could go to the next slide, I'm gonna actually step through. So we lovingly came up with the acronym PARCA, like the PARCA warm coat. It was fun to develop that name, and we went through a few iterations, but that's an easy way to remember it. Just think of the coat. So the first is, you know, we recommend that you articulate the research question and the finite purpose of the project. And I know that when you hear this, it sounds like it's just very intuitive and it seems like common sense, but believe it or not, it doesn't happen all of the time. And this will guide your entire rapid qualitative project from designing your data collection instruments all the way through your matrix and your reporting. So you really want to do this and let this research question kind of be your guiding star. And we want you to revisit that research question over and over. So we do have a training hub. All the authors on this manuscript are part of that training hub. And Dr. Erin Finley, who we have to get a shout out to because she was one of the major contributors for this manuscript and work, was just saying the other day in one of our trainings that she likes to make sure that she has the research question listed on the interview guide, like on every page. And I thought, wow, that's really an amazing idea. Kind of a great way, like we're talking about here, to incorporate this throughout. So when someone's actually going through the interview, they're just always seeing that and having that research question at the back of their mind. That's going to be critically important. So if you go to the next slide, element two, when designing a study, the team should describe and document the reason for why you're using rapid methods. So this is similar to what I was talking about just two slides ago. And we've heard this, and maybe some of you have heard this too, that there is this perception that comes up from time to time where someone will say, oh, rapid qualitative methods should be the only form of qualitative inquiry going forward because it saves time and money. And while it's true that it can save you time and maybe sometimes money, it's absolutely not true that this should be the only form of qualitative inquiry. And in fact, there are some types of projects where you would find a very unfortunate mismatch if you were using this methodology. So not only do we want you to describe and document in your reporting the rationale for why you used it, but right now I'm just going to give you a brief introduction to like the types of projects that really are best suited to rapid. So if you're working on a project that has a narrow scope or a very focused research question, this should be a good fit for you. Of course, if you have limited time and there's an urgent need to deliver findings on schedule, whether maybe that's because you're working with an operational partner or you're working on something that has implementation involved, maybe you're working on a pilot or other brief study, a sample that has high information power, that was that term that I was just talking about, the Maltrude reference with the highly salient information about your research question, you're just gonna talk to a few people where they have this high information power, that would be a great fit. If you're doing phased work where the next steps are data dependent, maybe you did get lined up with an operational partner, a policymaker, and we know how that goes, and they say, I need this mission critical data, that could be a good fit. Again, if you have longitudinal work with multiple data collection waves, that can be another good reason to use these methods. So next slide. element three, we want you to think about, and I'm just going to take a moment to say this to make sure that this is clear. When we designed this, what we're calling a consensus-based framework or the PARCA, we were looking at things like the CORIC and other checklists that are out there. And while a lot of those are used later on in your research project, really more towards the end when you're doing something like reporting. Importantly, we designed this tool not just for you to use later on when you're reporting, but we wanted this to be a design and methods tool. So when I describe each of these elements to you, if you can kind of keep that framing in mind, that you can start having these discussions initially from the planning phase, that really is the intention of how we want people to use this framework, rather than waiting just until the end and kind of checking off, yeah, I did that. So in particular, this particular one here can help you. While I may talk about it in the reporting phase, it can also help with planning. So for example, those of us who serve as reviewers, and some people on our team serve as editors of journals, we find that when we receive these works from the field, often we'll see very vague phrases in methodology. And they may say something as simple as, we conducted rapid qualitative analysis. And so we're going to tell you as experts that have come together, that is akin to a black box. When you say we conducted rapid qualitative analysis, that can mean many, many different things. And essentially, we don't know what that means. So instead, we would recommend that you provide a detailed list of what you actually did. So kind of describe what you actually did, because these can vary. And these bullets here, these little boxes anyway, will give you an indication of the ways that they can vary. So for example, some of us in our teams, you know, looking at data types, some of us in our teams, like Dr. Hamilton, prefer to always use transcripts. Some of us prefer to use audio files. Some of us prefer to use audio files and notes. If you take our training or you take a training, you'll understand a little bit more the nuances of what we mean by that and what the differences are. The important thing I just want to say right now is that none of those are wrong. It's not that one's wrong or one's better than the other. However, it's important when you do this work that you document what you did do. So what was your data type? How did you collect the data? How did you prepare the interview guide? How did you actually do the analysis? How did you develop the matrix? And so when you write these things out, what you're doing is you're actually being transparent and you're offering a replicable view of your methods for reviewers and readers and other people that may want to do similar work. So the next slide, element four, takes us into model series and frameworks. In this qualitative collaborative, we don't talk about that as much. In the implementation collaborative, we talk about it all the time. But just to say, theories, models, and frameworks can be helpful in focusing the scope for your rapid qualitative project. So you can use them, but they are definitely not required. Whereas with implementation, we would say the expectation is that you're using one. With rapid qualitative work, you can use one, but we don't want this to be used as any indication of a lack of rigor if someone's not using one. That's definitely not the case. However, if your team decides to use one because you think it will be helpful, we recommend that you document the rationale on why you decided to use one and why, for example, you're using that particular one. And then it's useful to define the constructs and elements that will and importantly will not be included. So Dr. Nevidal, who's presenting with me, she has a very sentinel paper where they compared traditional analysis to rapid using the CIFAR. And so an example would be, you know, maybe you're using the CIFAR, but you're only going to use certain constructs because, again, with rapid, think focused, think telescoped. And so you would want to document which constructs you chose to use and why. And then we also want you to describe how those constructs will be integrated into data collection. You know, of course, you probably heard this phrase and we see it sometimes, you know, lip service to a model theory or framework. If you're saying you're using a framework, there should be some representation of that that's very clear in your data collection instrument, which most likely would be an interview guide. There also should be some representation of that in your matrix and analysis. So that's kind of obvious that you're integrating and truly using that framework throughout. So the next slide this is just defining, I shouldn't say just, because it's actually really, really important, but in order to achieve rigor and validity, which is what this whole framework is focused on, the intended timeframe really needs to be defined. And so just to really bring this point to home, we have members in our hub and authorship team that have worked on rapid projects where from planning to dissemination, the entire thing is 6 months. That's not to say that's always the case. Sometimes it's 12 months. But I want to make this striking to you that you can be talking about a really short time frame. And so you can see how this here becomes very critical. Because if you're working with 6 months, or maybe you're lucky enough to have 12, if you're not meeting your deadlines, you need to become aware of that very quickly. And so we want you to do like a Gantt chart that kind of talks about how long are you going to collect data? When are you going to analyze? When are you going to disseminate? And just to mention that Dr. Nevidal does a lot of work on longitudinal studies. If any of you are doing that as well, you may need to specify timeframes for each of those phases. Just keep that in mind. So again, why this is important, beyond just facing delays, if you're not able to meet these timeframes that you set, you may not be able to achieve your sample size that you've said you're going to use. And all of that can negatively impact your study rigor, which is what we're trying to avoid. So the next slide, element 6 is planning for appropriate staffing. This seems to be an area when we do these trainings in the hub where people get stuck, and I understand why. So I'm actually going to spend, I think it's more like 3 slides on this one element, just because it's something that comes up a lot that seems to be problematic for people to understand, and an area where there's a lot of questions. So like we were just talking about with the timelines and meeting those abbreviated timeframes, why you need to budget to make sure you're doing that. Feasibility is also related to staffing, which is related to budgeting. So we typically recommend as a panel of experts, again, from this authorship team and the Rapid Hub, that you have at least 2 people, ideally, and oftentimes more than that, depending on how abbreviated the study is. But the number of team members is proportional to the scope of the study. And on the next few slides, I'll kind of show you what I actually mean by that. So the next slide shows, basically one of the most common questions that we get is, just tell me how many staff I need. If I have 30 interviews, how many staff am I going to need? And we say, and it's not always everybody's favorite answer to hear, that it truly does depend. This list here shows you the A through E, what it actually depends on. Of course, Dr. Hamilton and Erin have been on projects where they've had over 100 interviews. Although that's maybe not the norm, you can use rapid qualitative methods for that. Maybe you have a project where there's 15 interviews. Those are going to be very different staffing levels required. You're going to need to take notes. We recommend calendar blocking. You're going to need to manage the data and clean it, work on your analysis, and then, of course, work on your dissemination. And so ideally, we also recommend that your interviewers are involved in both data collection and analysis optimally. So on the next slide, I actually am sharing a specific example that we've used in our training, just because at least this gives you some semblance of what we mean instead of just talking about it so abstractly. So in this example, we're going to say that you have 30 rapid qualitative interviews that are semi-structured that are going to need to be, planned, completed, and analyzed and disseminated all within 6 months to meet your project goals. So this is kind of the staffing level we would recommend, and this is why we're again trying to dispel that myth that it's easy to do this and you can get by with less money. Because if you're going to do all this work in 6 months, what we would recommend is that you would have 2 50% qualitative analysts and also 1 30% qualitative methodologist. And I'm not going to read through all the bullets below that because we just kind of went through some of these tasks, but that's basically an idea of why you need that amount of staff, because these are the kind of things that they're going to be working on during that 6 month period. So the next slide is element 7. And Again, this may seem like it's obvious to you, but it's really important. And again, it's not always done to clarify to every team member, everybody involved on the project, what the roles are going to be. And we're always coming back to this research question, that light bulb that's kind of the guiding light. We've seen projects where sometimes maybe someone's using a model theory and framework, and say they get so embedded in those constructs throughout this process that they have actually lost sight of the overarching research question. We always want you to come back and have every member of the team revisiting that, so that doesn't happen. And again, teamwork really is one of the most essential pieces of rapid qualitative work. And teamwork is a really excellent way to ensure that your work is done rigorously. Marge Sandalowski, who's an icon in the field and many of you know, she used to say that everybody has a leaner slant when you're doing this work, and that's kind of unavoidable. And so when you bring in different perspectives throughout having different members in a team, this can be a way that you can add different views and reinforce the rigor of the work that you're doing. I do want to say, because someone's going to ask this question, it always comes up in the real world, what if I'm the only person doing this? I just want to normalize that in the real world with budget constraints, this does happen sometimes. You could always contact one of us. We could have a sideline conversation about what you can do in those instances. But also to say, this consistent team communication can prevent drift that otherwise will happen, because it always happens in your data collection and analysis amongst team members. And don't worry, if you don't know what I mean by that, in the next few slides, you'll have a much better idea of what I'm talking about. So if you can go to the next slide, Andrea, we're now shifting in the Parca into data collection. And that's going to be elements 8 through 10 that I'm going to go through. So if you can go to the next slide, we'll talk about element 8. And I know this kind of seems overwhelming. Again, we recommend that you take a training. This is kind of an introduction to the Parca and what it is. If you've never done rapid qual before, it's too much of an expectation to think you're just going to listen to this one seminar and be able to do it. Our trainings, for example, are 6 hours. There are ones that you can pay for that are like 3 days. But this is hopefully just a really good introduction to the kinds of things that you should be doing. So element 8, we're shifting now from that rigorous planning we were doing into actual data collection. So this is where we're talking about developing a concise data collection tool. And so what we like to say is, whereas those of you who may be doing traditional qualitative work, you're casting a very wide net traditionally when you're doing these interviews, I want you to try to think about rapid qualitative as being telescoped and focused. And so the best way we can describe this, and I got this from Dr. Allison Hamilton and Dr. Aaron Finley, is to say, think about it as you're asking these people, specifically defined, these questions that are focused and structured. So that's kind of a good way, again, that you can use to differentiate a good fit for rapid from traditional. These people asking specific questions. So these guides should be shorter, less intensive than a traditional guide. We want the interview length to be kept low burden for the participants. Typically, they're around 30 minutes. They may stretch to 45 minutes. They're not going to be an hour long. You know, they might even only be 20 minutes long. And then we want you to make sure that any other data collection tools that you're using, for example, structured templates, should also be as focused as your interview guide will be. So if you don't mind going to the next slide, element 9. Excuse me for taking a drink. For those of you who are part of my other collaboratives, know I had no voice last week. I want to keep it going through the session today, so I'm drinking periodically. Apologies. Element 9, Dr. Hamilton, Allison Hamilton, who couldn't be with us today, but is an integral part of this team, likes to emphasize that pilot testing is very important, and it makes sure that the questions that you're going to be asking actually make sense. And it also helps to make sure that the interviewer who's going to be reading those questions feels comfortable saying those questions out loud. So this is not a step that should be skipped, really, no matter how many projects you've done, because Dr. Hamilton is one of the foremost experts, and she said she always does this step. Don't skip it. Please pilot test your interview guide and make sure, again, that the questions are focused. Not only are they clear and comfortable to the person who's saying them, but to the types of people you will be asking them, you know, making sure that they comprehend what you're getting at and kind of what's important to your research question and what you're asking of them. So the next slide, element 10, we want you to develop a plan for review throughout the data collection process. And again, this is something we would like you to use for planning, but this is also a really good indication that can be used in reporting. So if you report on doing something like this, these steps that we're going to outline here, to an operational partner through like a PowerPoint presentation, if that's how you're disseminating, or through a manuscript. Again, this is going to be a signal to your operational partner or to your readers. Wow, this was done very rigorously. And again, kind of the whole point of this presentation is, how do I know if I'm doing this right? Because a lot of people are new to RAPID, it's novel. And so this is one of the ways you can be doing it right. So we don't want this to just go on like, oh, everybody kind of goes their own way and they're doing data collection. No, we want you to have regular review. We found through our teams doing this over many sites, over many years, it's critically important that you do one of these kinds of reviews. So for example, you can have weekly interview debriefs where everyone that's working on the interviews comes together and you can talk about how you could make the interviews better moving forward. You can do interview reflections, or you can have methods feedback sessions. So this would be where if you have one person that's seen as the qualitative lead, they can actually listen to and provide feedback on the interviews to ensure that they're consistent and importantly, that they're obtaining adequate answers to the focused research questions. We call this drift. It tends to happen a lot with traditional, and it may not be as important there, but here it's really important. You don't want this all to drift off into a long sideline conversation that really isn't focused. You want to always work on bringing it back to that research question. So once you've started data collection, make sure that you have these plans for review throughout, and you'll find that it will really improve the rigor of the work that you're doing. So next slide, we're now going to step in summary template development, which will be elements 11 through 14. And if you could go to the next slide, we want you to develop and again pilot test a user-friendly summary template. That was not a word. So these templates need to be clear and they should be based on the interview guide and not unwieldy. And I will show you a little bit more about what I mean by that in just a moment. So this will make it clear for you. But basically, these summary templates, so you're doing the interview, and then we want you to do like a two-page summary, which is kind of the next step in the RAPID qualitative project. They should at least initially be based on the questions from the interview guide. So again, you're going to find this different from traditional where you're out there thinking of codes. No, this is very structured. You're going from one to the other, and we don't want it to be unwieldy. So the next slide, we say, and if you take one of our trainings, there can be different ways to do this. I kind of alluded to that earlier in the presentation. Some people use transcripts, some people use audio files, but because your data is distilled so quickly in rapid qualitative analysis, we always recommend that you have continuous comparison and validation. And the way that you can do that is through linking to your raw data. With RAPID, this is going to be critically important. So how do you actually do that? What does that mean? Because you don't want these summaries to be too long. Like I just said, two pages, three at the most. Well, we want them to be at-a-glance friendly. So the way you can do that is by using transcript line numbers, if you're using transcripts. You can use brief quotes, and you can use timestamps. So Just to mention this briefly, some of us have worked on projects where you will go back later and do a little bit more in-depth analysis. You might have an analyst who's reading your summary and thinks, well, I didn't want to see a whole blob from the transcript here, but I want a little more context. If you put a timestamp in there, they can easily go back to the transcript and find out that additional context that they may need. So the next slide, element 13, we want these summaries to be accurate and concise, but detailed enough to meet project aims. So we on our team thought about this an awful lot. You wouldn't believe the number of conversations we had to come up with these four bullets. And so it seems a little nebulous. I'm going to read them for you because they're important, but just please rest assured, once you've done this for a while, you will just inherently know what we mean by this. And again, I'm going to show an example, but we came up with they should be connected to and reflective of the raw data, brief yet thorough enough to stand alone, minimally interpretive, and this is important. We don't want interpretation going on here. We want these summaries to be very grounded in the actual participant language, whether that be a provider or a patient. We want you to use their terms and not have an interpretation step here. And then we want these summaries to be streamlined but complete. So the next slide talks about different calibration processes that you can do to make sure that you have consistency happening. I'm going to step through these briefly, and then I'm going to show you an actual three examples that I think will make this very clear. One is going to show you a summary with too much, too little, and then just right. Kind of, I forget what the fairy tale, wasn't it like Goldilocks or something, but like that. So these are things that we want you to do. Prioritize again, the guiding light, the research question. Ensure that the format is consistent. You'll see a little what happens when that's not true in the next slide. Discuss again this, you don't want interpretation going on at this point in time. We recommend you use a training data set. So several researchers can use a training set to learn how to do this as they're going through. Meet regularly with the team. We talked about that already, kind of how you can do that. Use a secondary reviewer to spot check. And then employ consistent team processes for data condensation throughout the project. So I hope you'll like these next three slides. They go over really, really well. If you can go to the next slide, Andrea, in our trainings that we do, which are longer, they're like 6 hours. Please let me just say, the intention is not for you to read this text. If you want to read it later, great, that's fine. The intention is just that you see what happens, what can tend to happen when someone just is new to this. And also, let me just say, no matter how you train everyone on your team, every time when you start, someone's going to come up with a summary like this. And that's why it's important to do these data checks. So you can see this is the long version, the too much. There's minimal summarization here. So while on the plus side, it does provide high levels of detail and it's very grounded in the participant language, you can also see the data and formatting make rapid summarization and review of this very difficult. This is not at a glance friendly. And this is also something that tends to happen when someone is new and working with transcripts. So the next slide shows you, and you might laugh, and often when we're doing training, people laugh and they're like, this would never happen, but this is an actual example, okay? All three of these came from, these are actual project work. This is an actual example that someone actually did from summarizing that same interview. So it's just way too short. And so trying to find the positives here, the data points are accurate and the most salient points are included, but clearly, this data is too summarized and too flattened. It's missing context and nuance that we all need. There's no quotations, which means someone would have to go back and look through the transcripts later. So we also don't want this. So the next slide is something you can review and take more time to look at later. But this is the right level of detail that we're looking for. This is the calibrated version. This is a summary that includes a balance of detail without being too in the weeds. The other thing that you're going to notice is see these headers that are underlined where it says like distance drive. This is at a glance friendly. This is that phrase that Dr. Hamilton likes to use. You can look at this and you can quickly get a good picture of what was actually going on here. So, you know, we don't have time to delve into this much more, but you can get copies of these slides and look at this later, and I hope it will be helpful to you. This is kind of the level that we're looking at that enables you to have that at a glance friendly. And again, the key here is consistency. I just want it to stick in your mind that too much, too little, this, you're going to see this variation in your team, and that's what you want to avoid and why you want to have those check-ins where you're coming together to kind of make sure that everyone's giving you the same level of detail. So if you'll stick with me, and I know we're almost done. I know this has been a lot to absorb, and I really appreciate you hanging in there. But the next few slides, I'll quickly go through 15, 16, and 17, which are now jumping into the matrix. You've done your interviews, you've done your summaries, and now you're going to put your data into the matrix. And so you want to make sure, again, just like all of the other approaches, that you're honing the data, you're narrowing the data, and you're focusing at every step. So when you're getting to the matrix, it's going to be even more focused and honed. So in contrast to traditional, this is a more deductive analytical approach. Again, I think I mentioned this, but you can develop your matrix before you even start data collection. It's a priori, so it makes it nice. So you can do these matrices, but what we want you to do is ensure that the domains that you put in the matrix are clearly defined and appropriate. So when people are going through and using them, when you're going to get into the worst trouble at this point is if one of your analysts is like, do I put in this domain or this domain? There's too much overlap here. I just don't know. That's what you really want to avoid happening. That's where you're going to run into trouble. So we want you to clearly define those so that those different domains are the distinction between those domains is very clear. So the next slide, I know this has been a whirlwind. Keep thinking about your questions. I've been talking, so I haven't been checking the Q&A, but if you have questions, please, this is a great time to think about them. Put them in the panel because in a few minutes, we're going to be ready to talk to all of you. So this is 16 and 17 on the same page. Just like we were talking about in the prior sections and for the matrix as well, we want you to review for accuracy and consistency. I want to quickly say, sometimes we've seen that people will use QDOS, if you're familiar with that, qualitative data analysis software, like Invivo, Atlas TI, as some type of indicator that their analysis is done rigorously. I said in the beginning, as reviewers will see, you know, I did rapid qualitative analysis. One thing I left out is sometimes they'll just say, I did rapid qualitative analysis in Invivo. And a reviewer's like, there we go. That's rigorous. That's what they did. Unfortunately, though, there's great utility to those software packages. That should not be seen as an indication of rigor. And conversely, the majority of us on this team and the authors of this publication use Excel and Word for our matrices. That should not in any way, shape, or form, and we wrote this in the text of the paper, be seen as some type of lack of rigor. We do that just because it works well for us. When you have a table or something, it's this at-a-glance friendly. I'm going to show you two examples in just a moment of what we mean by that. And you can do that just marvelously in Excel and Word. So for this part of your rapid work, don't worry if you're not using a qualitative data software package. Again, just like the others, number 17 is this review, this kind of periodic monitoring in the same way as I was showing you with the summaries. You can expect to see a little bit of that variation too as people are putting data into the matrix. So keep an eye on that. And then the next slide, the last one, we're at the end, is 18, synthesis. It's the last element, hooray. So data synthesis, and in her trainings, Andrea talks about this, that sometimes people get to the point in rapid when they're done with their matrix, and they're like, yay, I'm done. You're not done. You need to synthesize, and you need to look across your matrix. That's what the matrix is for. The synthesis process is just as important. So. Although what you're going to do with your synthesis is dependent on your operational partners and your deliverables, just make sure that you are doing the synthesis and that you're what basically what you're doing is you're looking for patterns within or across cases or domains. This is the step at which now you can have a little bit more interpretation in order to take your findings and relate them to existing literature or interested parties. So I'm just going to show you quickly just two examples. The next slide, this one here is, and don't worry about reading the text. This is just to give you an indication, just a very quick indication of the level of data that you might expect to see in a matrix. So don't get bogged down in the content here, but as you can see, there's not a lot of text there, but the point is getting across and it's at a glance friendly. This is an example with neutral domains, and this is an example without using a model theory or framework. I'm just going to quickly, I have one more slide before I turn it back over to Andrea. If you go to the next slide, this is just another example matrix. The idea is not, again, for you to read this text right now, but this one uses the CIFAR, and we don't need to get mired into the details of that. But again, this will just give you, if you're doing this work yourself, a really good indication of the level of data that we want you to see and consistently see when people are working on the matrix. So now I'm going to turn it over to back to Dr. Nevidal to give us conclusions, and then we're going to open it up to all of you to hear from you and your questions.
Thanks, Christine, for the awesome overview of the PARCA. I wanted to wrap up here and just say that in conclusion, the PARCA framework has helped advance literature in several ways. That although rapid qualitative methods have been critical to implementation science and other fields, the guidance on best practices really has been limited, and so that's why we developed it. The PARCA framework helps to fill an important gap in the literature by offering standardized criteria to help with rigorous planning, conduct, and evaluation of rapid qualitative studies. And that the PARCA provides an expert-driven resource to support high-level methodological rigor in real-world qualitative implementation science research. The next slide. We just have some key references here, just in case anyone is interested. I wanted to point that out. We have a couple links to some other VA cyber seminars on rapid analysis. The first one is the updated one from Dr. Allison Hamilton. And lastly, we just wanted to say thank you so much for the opportunity to present today. We'll open it up for questions. And if there are any questions that we can't get to today, you're always welcome to email us, and we're happy to help. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Andrea. And I see we have some great questions in here, so we can walk through them. And Andrea, if there's any that you see that you want to, usually I'm able to triage these as others are presenting. I couldn't do that today, so I'm just going to go through them one at a time. So where can we find more information about the PARCA trainings? That's a great question. So we do have a training hub. I can put a link in here if people are interested in being put on a wait list. Unfortunately, we have a wait list right now for our trainings, but I will put a link in into the chat for people so you can see that. So this first question, is time, okay, so I guess it, I think it's if time has passed since data collection, maybe I'm not reading this right. If time has passed since data collection, a rationale for rapid qualitative now. So you have data collected and unanalyzed for greater than 5 years. Do you want to answer that, Andrea?
Sure.
I have thoughts about it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So I see what you mean. It's like sometimes you might do a secondary analysis. And so it's not rapid in the sense of like it occurring when you're collecting the data, but you certainly could do a rapid analysis process when you're like, I need to rapidly assess what we collected many years ago. And so you could follow the similar steps and it will be conducted in a shorter time frame. So that's just something I think it's really important just to talk about where the data came from. And then it would be maybe more of like a secondary analysis that's done, you know, years later on a prior data set.
Yep. Great. Excellent. So this next question regarding number 9, piloting the data collection tool, I would be more interested in details about best practices for pilot testing the data collection tool. For example, how much time do you typically spend piloting the interview guides? How many people? Yeah, that's a really great question. And so I think obviously in an ideal world, we could spend a lot of time on this. We sometimes don't have that amount of time, but I would say it's important that you involve all of the team members who would be doing this. So have them do at least one or two practices. You can kind of do this as a group too. I would say that each person should practice using the interview guide with someone at least one time, and then they could listen in to others doing the same thing. So say you're going to have two interviewers, you know, a minimum of two pilot tests, I would say. You know, I don't know that there's a steadfast rule. You could do like two each. But I think the more you do this, you'll really get a sense as they're pilot testing the interview guide. I'm sorry. And in this case, I think this is actually referring to the data collection tool. I don't know if this means the interview guide or the actual summary summary template, but you can put a note in about that. But yeah, Andrea, what do you think beyond what I said about how many you would?
Yeah, I think it also depends on, you know, how complicated the guide is. If you're really not sure if some of the questions are going to land well, especially sometimes, like if you're using a framework, you don't want it to be like too jargony with the people that you're interviewing. So that sometimes can take a little bit of practice to go from like how a framework words something versus like how can you actually say it to someone that like it resonates with them. And so, and for veteran interviews, oftentimes we'll ask like the Veteran and Family Advisory Council to see if there might be a veteran who could participate. But sometimes you maybe don't have a pilot person like on your team or through the council. So sometimes I'll even just treat the first couple of interviews of like the actual participants as a pilot if I don't have the right people to test it out with. And then I just really kind of do that slowly and cautiously. So we'll do that first interview and then like really reflect on what needs to be changed moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you so much. Oh, there's some really good questions here. I'm excited about this. People are listening really, really well. So this next question, which is great because I think, you know, real world, this does happen. So it came from Amanda. As a young researcher starting to design my first internal VA pilot with budget limitations that do not allow hiring an RA, is it possible to use rapid qualitative analysis as described, i.e. how might I create a team of multiple partners? This is a great, great question. And this is real world. And like we said, sometimes this happens to all of us. And yes, I would just say, just make sure that as you're thinking about your VA pilot, that as we described, that this is a good fit. So regardless of the fact that you only have one person, are you going to have a more telescoped and narrowed research question? You know, think about some of those things first before picking this methodology. If that's true, you can do this yourself. And so we've talked about ways where, you know, like we said about the slant, and you can try to do, you know, checks on yourself for consistency. And I'll ask Andrea to take a moment to talk about this too. But another thing we recommend if you can, and we actually have all done this at times, sometimes if you can find a medical student to work with you, at least if you have someone else who can volunteer and get something out of helping you with this, this can actually help. We know it doesn't always happen, but we do really, really recommend at least two people for rigor. That said, you know, you definitely can do rigorous work by yourself. So I don't want you to be left with the impression like, oh no, I'm sunk. I can't do this by myself. Andrea, did you want to add anything about that?
I think it also depends like on your methods experience. So if you're like completely new to qualitative methods and rapid qualitative methods, I would really try to make sure that you have a qualitative methodologist that maybe or a mentor that you can work with, even if maybe they're willing to like donate time to help, you know, get you trained so that way you can do it like in the right way. Cause I think it can be, people can get kind of like really tripped up on the process if they have never done this before. And there's definitely been times when I've done the work myself. And then like more recently I had there was an RA on the project who really didn't do qualitative methods. But I asked that person to just listen to the audio and look at what I had written and summarized just to see if maybe there were some things that I missed. And I felt like that was the way that they could kind of help contribute to the process, even though we didn't have a lot of time to train that person in how to do rapid analysis, but they could kind of verify that I didn't totally like misrepresent something that someone said. So hopefully that gives you some tips, but you can always reach out to us later too if you have more questions.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much, Andrea. So this question is another great one. I have recently had some non-qualitative research challenge my lack of use of inter-rater reliability
Oh.
as a measure of reliability. Maybe I'll let Andrea answer this one because she's working on a paper about this right now. Since most rapid studies don't use QDOS, how do you respond seeing something like the IIR measure? I'm just going to say super quickly, we're doing away with this. None of us use it anymore. So unfortunately, sometimes you do have to really push back and do a little bit of light, balanced education about this. But it's not recommended. But Andrea, do you want to say something? Because this is going to be in your paper, right? That's
Yeah, we're working on a paper right now about misperceptions and biases, sort of like against qualitative methods. And this is one of the key topics that we've identified. And it is something that's really not very used very often. So I would just push back and say that IIR is actually for like a very, very specific type of data collection and analysis, and it really doesn't apply. And it's actually really not always that useful. It may be something that is very reliable, but it's not always valid. It doesn't actually mean that people are coding the right types of text and whatnot. And also you're not coding in rapid analysis as well. So I think you said like maybe in the rapid analysis work that you're doing. So you're not coding in the way, so it doesn't really make sense to do that anyways. So if you need help kind of with how to push back on that, you can always message us and we can try to like help you with that. But I would just reference more of like consensus-based approaches are definitely more appropriate for rapid analysis. And IIR really it doesn't apply.
Yeah, excellent. You asked the right person. Dr. Nevidal has great answers for you on that one. So the next question from Lisa, I like this question. Thank you for this. The slide, I thought about this too as I was saying it, and I for time didn't say anything, but clearly I should have. So the slide about defining your research question mentioned you should note if other questions arise. This seems counter to the rest of your advice. Stick to your original interview guide. Is the purpose of noting new research questions that arise simply to get ideas for a future study? So absolutely great question. And I should say, so not necessarily, I hope it wasn't represented in the way of other research questions, but although we said a lot of this is done in an a priori way, and it should be, all of us on this team will find that we have like an other category. Sometimes something arises and it's not a new research question itself. It's not a new overarching research question, but some semblance of this, some probe or some specification of it that you didn't necessarily see would be important, but it's become clear as you've done these interviews that it is important. And so it's not always going to happen, but it happens at times. So it's not to say that this is bad. It's not bad. We've all done it. We keep this other category. To reiterate, we are not changing the research question, but there's some facet of it that maybe we didn't plan to have a domain for in our matrix. So I don't want to make this confusing and make it seem like, oh yeah, you can completely change your matrix around like traditional. It's not like that at all. It's like maybe one thing that you hadn't anticipated. Keep that other category. It's important to note those things because these things can happen. Like, and I don't know if you want to say more about that, Andrea, and maybe you'll say it in a better way, because I know that you do this sometimes too.
You know, I think that sounds good. I think we only have like a couple minutes left, so maybe if there's
Yeah.
any other last questions, and then people can
Okay.
always reach out to us too if there's something.
Yeah, exactly. I know we have so many questions. I wish we could. I'll try to maybe quickly do two more because sometimes they let us run like a minute over. But apologies if we didn't get to your question. Whitney, maybe if we can get a copy of the remaining questions, I can respond to them over email if you don't mind. But I'll just go. So this one says InVivo has an AI feature that helps identify theme. What's the role of AI? Oh gosh, we could talk about this for a really long time. And we actually just did in my qualitative methods advisory board. And I just think this is a really important distinction to make right now. So, while there are certain claims being made that AI can generate themes, kind of as a hub in this authorship team, we've made a statement that the data is not there yet to demonstrate that that is the case. And it's not to say that it won't be in the future. And maybe there are things that AI at this point in time qualitatively can do well for you, like counting. However, we just don't have adequate time to really answer that right now. I would just take that with a very important note of caution, that just be cautious about the role of AI in your rapid qualitative work at this point. They're really, although I know the Atlas TI in particular is pushing this use and saying that it can generate codes for you in themes, we have not seen evidence that it does this in the way that it's done well by adequately trained humans. So the jury's still out on that. I guess maybe I don't want to keep people over. There are other wonderful questions here, and I really appreciate them, but I'll try to follow up with each of you over email to give an answer to that. But I just wanted to say thank you so much to Dr. Nevidal, and thank you so much to all of you for joining. We had like about 300 people on. That's amazing. And you all clearly were super engaged because you asked such wonderful questions, and we really, really appreciate that. There are resources, like we have our emails listed here. We have our Twitter listed here. You can definitely look up the paper for more details. And just thank you all so much for joining. Andrea, did you want to say anything else before we close out?
Just thank you. And yeah, we appreciate you being here and for the awesome questions.
Yeah, we appreciate you so much. And thank you for, and Whitney is going to mention a brief survey that we'll ask some of you to fill out. But thank you so much for your engaged time today.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you, Andrea. To our attendees, when I close the meeting, you'll be prompted with a feedback form. Please take a few moments to complete the form. We really do appreciate and count on your feedback to continue to deliver high-quality cyber seminars. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR Cyber Seminar, and we look forward to seeing you at a future session. Have a great day, everyone.
Yep, thanks so much. Take care. We'll see you next month. Bye.